Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, one of whose most important fronts at the moment, unquestionably, involves the Islamic Republic of Iran. It is much in the news, of course, of late because of the so-called deal that has been announced in recent days by the Obama administration and several other nations concerning the nuclear program and ambitions of this Islamic State. It is also much in the news because it is involved in all manner of other mischief. And I am thrilled that we have a full hour to discuss both the nuclear program, what might be done about it with respect to this negotiation, and what other options we have, with a man who has studied this matter closely, spent a lot of time both in government and out, advancing ideas about how to address it, and who has written, among other things, a very important book on the subject entitled A Time to Attack, The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat. He is Dr. Mac Kronig. He is an associate professor and international relations field chair at my alma mater, the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He is also a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council and, as I said, has served in a number of important positions in the U.S. government, including in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Also, as an advisor on foreign policy matters to former presidential candidate Mitt Romney. Dr. Kronig, welcome, and thank you very much for giving us a full hour of your time to discuss this incredibly important subject and hopefully do justice to it.
Well, Frank, thank you very much for having me back on the program. It's always a pleasure, and I'm glad to be back.
Well, it's our pleasure, needless to say, because I think there's so many pieces of this that it really does require a proper drill down. And I'd like to start, I think, in this first segment by asking you some questions about the nature of the Iranian regime itself and manifestations of that nature that involve, of course, the nuclear component, but other pieces as well. But because the nuclear component is so much in the news, talk, if you would, a bit about a notion that has taken hold in official Washington that because of a fatwa and sort of spiritual edict issued by, I believe, both the original supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, and his successor, Ayatollah Khamenei, that nuclear weapons are not consistent with Islam's teachings, that we don't need to be terribly worried about an Iranian bomb. What do you make of that?
Yeah. Well, you just have to look at what the Iranian regime has been doing over the past 30 years. They've built up this nuclear program over 30 years. They've spent over $100 billion on it. They're doing things that are absolutely inconsistent with a peaceful nuclear energy program, like building component parts for nuclear weapons, a lot of other things. So it's pretty clear that they've been working hard to build nuclear weapons. So I think that when the Supreme Leader makes a comment like that, you have to question, why are they doing all this other stuff if they're really not interested in building nuclear weapons?
So your point is that there is no doubt in your mind, at least, that this is not simply a nuclear power program, but just a cover for the other component, which they've actually been quite seriously pursuing for, by some estimates, 30 years.
Exactly. I don't think there's an ounce of credibility to this idea that it might just be for an energy program. And on the Supreme Leader's fatwas, I'm not an expert on Muslim theology myself, but I'm told by people who are that, one, there's a question about whether that was really a fatwa or not. It might have just been something he said in a sermon, which apparently is different from a fatwa. And then second, I'm told that it's actually quite easy for Shia clerics to change fatwas over time, and it would be very easy for the Supreme Leader to say the interests of the country have changed, the supreme interest of the country and the Islamic revolution is paramount. therefore I'm changing a previous fatwa to a new one that says now we need nuclear weapons to defend the Islamic Republic. So in short, the fatwa, whatever else you want to throw at it, I think there's no doubt Iran wants nuclear weapons.
Well, and there is a tradition going back to the time of Muhammad himself in which making hudnas or temporary deals not to exceed 10 years while you constitute the capability to destroy the people you're making that temporary truce with. And I'm fearful that quite apart from everything else you've said, which I think is also true, there is very much this inherent in that tradition that the mullahs practice with quite, you know, serious purpose. Let me turn to a couple of other pieces of this, Matt. And again, our guest is Dr. Matthew Kronig, that are also in play here. They've been largely ignored or set aside, at least for the purposes of pursuing this negotiation. And we'll talk more about the deal in the next segment. But talk, if you would, about these other attributes that are also very troubling, namely the sponsorship of terrorism, the active subversion of other nations in the Middle East, the threats that are, you know, endlessly advanced against both our allies and our forces in the region, and for that matter, against us.
Well, yeah, well, because one of the questions people will raise over the nuclear program is, you know, would a nuclear armed Iran be a threat? Maybe it would get nuclear weapons and be feel safer and actually be more passive. But I think to answer that question, you just need to look at the goals and the behavior of the regime right now. We know this isn't a status quo country. The leaders have said explicitly that their goal is to become the most dominant state in the Middle East. And we see that revisionist behavior on the ground now with their support to terrorist and proxy groups, course of diplomacy. So I think there's no doubt that if they were to acquire nuclear weapons, they would become even more aggressive because that would provide a shield under which they could engage in this aggressive behavior.
With impunity, of course. Yeah.
With impunity, because we know now that one of the reasons, it's not that restrained, but we know in the past that when Iran has restrained its behavior, it's been because it feared that if it went too far, it might invite an attack from Israel or from the United States. But if it had nuclear weapons and felt like it could deter that attack, then again, it would provide them a shield to get away with whatever they wanted to get away with in the region.
Yeah. Again, and Matthew Kronig is our guest. You are distinguished, among other things, for your time in the Pentagon as having thought seriously about how do you deter terrorists. And in this case, I think things are made even more complicated by virtue of not only the sort of hegemonistic ambitions that you rightly ascribe to these guys, but also, of course, the sort of millennial character of the regime that they envision bringing back the 12th imam on their watch, and in so doing are described, prescribed by their end time theology as having to create conditions that sound an awful lot like the apocalypse. How does that factor into all this thinking?
Yes, I mean, many have pointed out that despite all the inflammatory rhetoric, the Iranian Republic has been pragmatic in its foreign policy in the past, and I think that's at a minimum open to debate given the support for terrorism, and they're willing to cross international norms that other countries aren't willing to cross. But even if that's the case, even if they are pragmatic, do we really want to risk nuclear war with this country that has hegemonic ambitions, that is willing to violate international norms? And now there's no risk of nuclear war whatsoever, but once they have nuclear weapons, that risk of nuclear war will always be present. So I do think there is a real risk of nuclear war if Iran gets nuclear weapons. So I think Israel's leaders, when they say this is an existential threat, I don't think it's an exaggeration. It is. And the Pentagon has pointed out just recently, actually, the director of the Missile Defense Agency said that by the end of this year, Iran could have a ballistic missile capable of reaching the continental United States. So this just isn't about the region. It just isn't about Israel. It's a direct threat to the United States of America.
Well, and especially so, given that we've had the spectacle of the Supreme Leader during these negotiations actually leading chants of death to America. And, of course, as you know so well, Matthew Kronig, having as a policy this idea that a world without America is not only desirable but achievable. We'll talk more in a moment about kind of what the implications of a failed deal will be. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about the nature of the so-called deal with Matthew Kronig of Georgetown University and the Atlantic Council, the author of The Time to Attack, The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz for the Center for Security Policy. Over the last week, it has become clear that the so-called framework agreement announced by the Obama administration to bring about a comprehensive nuclear deal with Iran is in deep trouble. Iranian officials have disagreed with the Obama administration's account of the framework, especially over verification and sanctions relief. Contrary to U.S. claims that there will be strict verification and phased sanctions relief, Iranian leaders have said verification efforts will be limited, with military facilities off limits. They also insist that sanctions must be completely terminated, not suspended, once a final agreement is signed. So if there was not agreement on the framework, what's going on here? The likely explanation is that the framework is a fraud to stop Congress from passing legislation imposing new sanctions on Iran or requiring a congressional vote on a final nuclear agreement. It is my hope Congress will not be fooled by this obvious fraud. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back with a very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio. It is an hour-long conversation with one of the most thoughtful observers and practitioners on the question of what to do about an Iranian nuclear threat. He is Dr. Matthew Kronig, an associate professor and International Relations Field Chair at the Department of Government in Georgetown University. He is also a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and author of numerous books and articles, but most recently, a tremendously important and insightful analysis, a book entitled A Time to Attack, The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat. Matthew Kronig, again, thank you very much for your time. We've been talking a bit about the nature of the Iranian regime, which really seems at the heart of the problem of trying to contend with its nuclear, among other threatening behavior. Let's talk now a little bit about the nature of the deal that we are insistently told has been achieved. Is, in fact, it the case, knowing what you know, reading what you read, being told what you're being told, that there is something that you can really point to by way of an actual agreement between Iran and the so-called permanent five plus one?
Well, the short answer is we don't have a deal yet. Many people have compared all this celebration to spiking the football on the five-yard line, and I think that's correct. We have an agreement to agree, but the final deadline is June 30th, and the idea is that the negotiators will continue to meet between now and June 30th and try to hammer out all the technical details. So we're not there yet. And another important point is it's not clear that this agreement to agree has all that much content to it. There was a kind of a vague statement read by the EU foreign policy chief and the Iranian foreign minister that didn't have much detail to it. And then the White House released a detailed fact sheet of all the things that Iran supposedly agreed to. And within minutes, the Iranian foreign minister came out and said, no, that's not right. We didn't agree to all that.
Our guest is Dr. Matthew Kronig with Georgetown University and the Atlantic Council, a man who has advised at the senior-most levels of the Office of the Secretary of Defense and been awarded for his service in so doing. He is the author most recently of A Time to Attack, The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat. I should say his most recent contribution in book length. He is also the author of a brand new piece at the Weekly Standard. We'll talk about that in a moment as well. But Matt, just drilling down on what the administration has claimed in this detailed fact sheet has been agreed, and the implications of the Iranians saying, no, that's not actually agreed at all. Maybe we could start with the question of the infrastructure that is being left in place. We're told that it's actually, this agreement is blocking all avenues to a nuclear weapon. Given what is being allowed to remain there, is that, in fact, in your judgment, the case?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. And you mentioned this Weekly Standard piece. And so what I point out in the piece is that for really 70 years, the United States has opposed the spread of enrichment and reprocessing technologies, the two so-called sensitive nuclear technologies, to any country, including our own allies. And we've gone to the mat with Taiwan, with South Korea, over the years to stop them from reprocessing. And what we're doing with Iran is making an exception. We've given up on prohibiting Iran from enriching altogether, and we're bargaining over how much enrichment they can do. And so I think it's an exception to make a mistake to make an exception for Iran, both because it will make it harder to stop them from building nuclear weapons. And I also worry about the precedent it sets for other states. I think other countries are going to other countries already are actually pointing to Iran's example and saying we want similar nuclear capabilities and rights.
I want to come back to that. Yeah, this is a tremendously important point, and I think one of the real ironies of this agreement is people promoting it seem to have lost their moorings in terms of their previous oft-stated attachment to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which has really, as arms control agreements go, been pretty successful. But let me just keep drilling down on this particular putative agreement with you, Matt. In addition to much infrastructure being left in place, there are claims that are being made about the verification regime that we're assured are going to enable the International Atomic Energy monitors to know in short order and with very high confidence that there are violations by the Iranians should they decide to try to break out using this infrastructure. What degree of confidence do you assign to the actual agreed verification arrangements as opposed to those that are being claimed by the administration?
Right. Well, there are two pieces here. So one is the inspector's ability to inspect the declared facilities, the facilities that we know exist, Natanz, Esfahan, Iraq, Fordo. And so if the deal that the White House announced is the deal, which, again, we're not quite sure, but if that is the deal, then inspectors will have access to those facilities. And I actually think that that could work, that they could monitor those declared facilities. The key question is the potential undeclared facilities or secret facilities. So the White House has claimed that the IAEA inspectors will have anytime, anywhere access. But in practice, that's impossible. And anybody with experience doing inspections knows that's impossible because, let's say, the United States or the IAEA detects that some facility is a secret nuclear facility and the IAEA asks for permission to visit. If Iran says no, there's really no recourse. And we've seen this with this Parchin military facility over the past 5 years or so. There's going to be no ability to monitor sites other than these declared sites. And so that's a real problem.
Yeah. And, you know, when I hear people like the Deputy National Security Advisor to the President, Ben Rhodes, talking about an anywhere, anytime inspection regime that will cover all military facilities and suspected undeclared sites, I have to say, especially in light of what you've just recounted, Matt, that this really is national security fraud. It's being perpetrated on the American people who, you know, would, I think, quite reasonably expect their government to tell them the truth. And yet, even if it had been agreed by the Iranians, and that certainly isn't the case, as you've indicated, it mechanically just doesn't work the way he's talking about. So where does that leave us in terms of concerns, as you have suggested you have as well, about other provisions of the deal? Does it really mean that you can't have confidence in any of the other commitments such as they are either?
Yeah. It means that if you're going to leave a major nuclear program in place like that, you want to have an ability to know that it's not being used to build nuclear weapons. And, as I pointed out, having that ability is nearly impossible. And so I think the only key to a successful deal is to make sure there isn't any enrichment or reprocessing. And that's the only way you can really verify it. Instead, this deal is, we're prepared to allow 6,104 centrifuges, but not 6,105 centrifuges. And that kind of level of specificity is trying to monitor and verify that is a fool's errand.
Mm-hmm. It's angels on the head of a pin trying to enumerate exactly how many there are. And Matt, I guess the last point on this, and we'll just pause for a quick second, is... The question as to why Iran feels the need to continue engaging in this kind of enriching. It's a subject of a piece that my colleague Fred Flights has at National Review last week, and I want to make sure we cover that point as well. It's evidence, I'm afraid, that they have malign intent, not benign. But that and more will be discussed with us and Matt Kronig in the next block as we discuss specifically the implications for this deal, for the region, for our allies, and for us. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your every day.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Hillary Clinton is running for president, in no small measure on the basis of her accomplishments as Secretary of State. The trouble is, there's not much there. For example, nearly a year ago, Hillary cheerleader and New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof wrote, quote, "Critics are right that Hillary Rodham Clinton never achieved the kind of landmark peace agreement that would make the first sentence of her obituary, but give her credit. She expanded the diplomatic agenda and adopted new tools to promote it, a truly important legacy," unquote. Now that she's a formal candidate, presumably Mrs. Clinton and her handlers will do a better job of spinning her claims to fame. But her real foreign policy legacy will be that of co-pilot for much of President Obama's disastrous one. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Affney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Our guest is Dr. Matthew Kronig. He is a duty expert on matters involving Iran and specifically its nuclear ambitions. He's written recently a very important and think quite thought-provoking book on the subject, in which he describes why this is, as he puts it, quote, a time to attack the looming Iranian nuclear threat. Matt is the author of numerous articles as well, including one that has just been published late last week in the Weekly Standard, entitled A Nuclear Turning Point, The Longstanding Bipartisan Nonproliferation Standard is Dead. And Matt, I want to pick up on that because we were discussing earlier the fact that Iran is being allowed to do something that successive U.S. governments and even the U.N. Security Council has said it could not be allowed to do, namely to continue enriching. Why do you think it is so insistent on having that capacity? And then we'll talk about why everybody else on the planet won't insist on having the same right.
Well, one thing that's important to understand is that Iran does not need to enrich uranium to have a peaceful nuclear energy program. The vast majority of countries on Earth with nuclear energy and nuclear power programs don't enrich their own uranium. They have it shipped in from other countries. They use the fuel and then they ship it out. So Iran can have an energy program like that if it wants. The reason it wants to make the fuel itself is because it wants to build nuclear weapons. I think that's pretty clear. And so U.S. policy for decades has been enrichment and reprocessing. These technologies for making fuel are off the table for everyone, including for our own allies. This was our policy for Iran for 10 years. This was, as you point out, the UN Security Council passed 6 resolutions demanding that Iran suspend. And then suddenly, after the interim deal last year, the Obama administration gave up on this and agreed to make an exception for Iran. So I think that's a terrible mistake that will lead to a weakening of the NPT and ultimately not achieve the goal it was intended to achieve. I think it'll make it more, not less likely that Iran builds nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and this is what I wanted to get to next is, unfortunately, it won't just be Iran who decides to pursue this nuclear weapons capability, which we're essentially legitimating, but its adversaries in the region are almost certainly going to follow suit. Some have made it very clear that they intend to do so. Let's talk a little bit about the implications of that, both from the point of view of the sort of goal of trying to prevent proliferation. The president has called it a world without nuclear weapons, but more precisely, given your knowledge of the region, Matt, what the probability is that we're actually teeing up a nuclear war perhaps there?
So Saudi Arabia, other countries in the region, UAE, have already said that whatever nuclear rights and capabilities Iran gets granted to it in this deal, that they're going to claim the exact same rights and capabilities. And the reason, I think, is to hedge their bets, that if Iran is going to be a few months away from building nuclear weapons, that they don't want to be left out. They also want to be a few months away from being able to build nuclear weapons. So I do think that this deal is laying the grounds for a nuclear arms race. I don't think it's as bad as if Iran had nuclear weapons, but I think you'll see this race of countries building latent nuclear capabilities. And at that point, it'll only be a matter of time before many countries, in addition to Iran, cross the nuclear threshold. The other thing I think that I worry about is that it won't only be the Middle East, because it's the other thing that's going on here is we're weakening this strict nonproliferation standard. So South Korea, for example, has been asking to reprocess for supposedly peaceful purposes for a long time. We've said no because there's a proliferation risk. But if we strike this deal with Iran, we can't go to Seoul and say, we trust Tehran with sensitive nuclear capabilities, but not you. So I think what we're going to see is the countries around the world claiming the right to enrich and reprocess, and it's going to be very hard for us to draw the strict line that we've drawn in the past in the wake of this Iran deal.
Let me ask you about another aspect of this that brings it literally closer to home, Dr. Matthew Kronig, and that is, as you indicated, the assessment of the United States government these days is that the Iranians are within a matter of months now of having ballistic missiles with which, presumably, they intend to deliver nuclear weapons. It's hard to imagine that there's another reason for them to have gone to the trouble of building up this missile capability if that's not the ultimate objective. One concern that I've had for a long time is that a ballistic missile equipped with a nuclear weapon could be obviously devastating to a city at which it is targeted, but it could be an existential threat to an entire country like ours if instead of detonating the nuclear weapon over a city, one detonates it higher up over maybe the center of the United States, something that would unleash something called electromagnetic pulse. When you hear the Iranian regime talk about this notion of a world without America being not only desirable but achievable, and you see these kinds of capabilities being put into place, do you think that that is something that we here in the United States have to be concerned about too, not just in terms of our interests and allies elsewhere?
That's exactly right. I think many people see the Iranian nuclear threat as a Middle Eastern problem, that it's something that we care about only because we have allies in the region. And I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I think it's a direct threat to the United States, and we'd be just as concerned even if we didn't have such close partners in the region. So point out, the director of the Missile Defense Agency said recently that Iran could have ballistic missiles capable of reaching the U.S. by 2015, sometime this year. And no country on Earth, not even the United States, builds ICBMs to put conventional warheads on them. The only reason they've been used historically is for nuclear weapons. So that's clearly what Iran has in mind. So any kind of future crisis between the United States and Iran could result and a nuclear attack against the United States. And as you rightly point out, I think many people think of either kind of full-scale nuclear war or nothing, but there are a lot of ways that countries can use nuclear weapons short of a full-scale nuclear war. for other limited military effects or for coercion or other things. So this is definitely a direct threat to the United States, not just a regional problem.
Yeah, and the degree to which the Iranians, who have been busily putting into place by testing missiles off of ships, for example, and testing them in a way that looks as though it's designed to simulate a detonation at apogee and therefore, you know, conducive to an EMP kind of strategic laydown. In addition to all that, we have learned from Congressman Trent Franks recently, as you may know, Matt, that in a document that was obtained from Iran in some 22 places, I believe, they specifically refer to their expectation of being able to use EMP weapons against the United States. So it's not as though we're imagining this or simply projecting. Again, our guest is Dr. Matthew Kronig. He is an associate professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, the author, among other things, of A Time to Attack, The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat. And Matt, we'll have to take another break here momentarily, but just quickly, what role do you believe Russia and China have been playing in all of this? They're, of course, part of this so-called PERM 5 plus 1, but are they on our side, or do they regard Iran as a client and therefore really on theirs?
Yeah, I guess I see them operating somewhere in the middle, neutral to some degree. So in the past, Russia and China had explicitly helped Iran with its ballistic program and nuclear program. Over the years, my best understanding is that that has mostly stopped, and that they have been fairly helpful with abiding by sanctions and participating in the diplomatic process. Not as helpful as we would like, of course, but they've been participating. But I've been to Beijing several times over the past few years to talk to officials there about this, and essentially what they say is they kind of want the problem to go away. They have other interests. They're trying to grow China Inc. They don't want Iran to get nuclear weapons, but they don't want a war in the region either. So they've essentially said that they're trying to stay out, let the United States and Iran work this out.
Well, especially given what we've been doing to accommodate the Iranians at every turn, I guess it hasn't been all that important or necessary for them to intervene on Iran's behalf. In fact, we've had a defector, as you know, Matt, from the Iranian delegation telling us that the role of the United States diplomats have largely been playing has been selling the Iranian position to the other parties to this negotiation. It's just it's bizarre. And unfortunately, if it weren't so serious, it would be hysterical. Matt, we have to pause for one last break. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Matthew Kronig, specifically on the question of, so what do we do now, given where we are on the Iranian nuclear threat? We'll have more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's sgtsullivancenter.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the Global Jihad Movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final segment of a very, very interesting and I hope illuminating conversation with Dr. Matthew Kronig, an extraordinarily thoughtful and I think influential figure in the debate now swirling about the Iranian nuclear weapons program, the diplomacy that is putatively heading it off, though there are some very serious questions about that, as we've been discussing. And I want to turn now with you, Matt, to sort of the hard part of this. Given all that you have said and the very real concerns that I think are rightly expressed by you and others about this non-deal and the emboldening of Iran that is almost certainly their principal takeaway from it, what should we do? You've written, of course, A Time to Attack, the looming Iranian nuclear threat. Is this now, in fact, a time for us to attack? And if so, is that really an option anymore?
Yeah. Well, my argument has always been that a limited strike on Iran's key nuclear facilities, is much better than acquiescing to a nuclear-armed Iran. But I've always also thought that if we can get a good deal, which for me would mean no enrichment in Iran, short of the use of force, that would be better. So I guess what I would recommend is, one, we abandon this bad deal that we're currently negotiating and go back to our old non-proliferation standard of no enrichment, and then give Iran a choice. Say on one hand, they can have continue to enrich, but it'll mean increasing international isolation, increasing sanctions, and if all else fails, military strikes on their nuclear facilities. Or they can have another option, and that other option is giving up their enrichment program, but getting sanctions lifted and getting other potential kind of face-saving goodies, maybe some non-sensitive nuclear technology research reactors or something like that. And I think if we lay that choice out clearly and stick to it, that Iran will eventually choose the latter choice. But overall, I think that option is much better than caving for this weak deal that we're currently considering.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I guess the question that occurs is, has that essentially been foreclosed as an option, at least under the present administration? They've certainly begun sort of chanting like a mantra this idea that it's this deal or war. There really isn't any other option. They insist that, among others, the Russians and Chinese won't go along with maintaining sanctions that have been loosened or that would be under this arrangement. The Iranians won't have any part of, you know, going back to square one. What are your thoughts on all of that, Matt Kronick?
Well, I think the administration, as you've said, has been making this case of it's this deal or war. But again, it goes back to what you were saying before. I think it's that they're not being straightforward with the American people. They're trying to sell the deal. If we don't get this deal, I can assure you that we're not going to start bombing the next day, that the administration will go back to doing something like what I just recommended of returning to the pressure track, increasing international sanctions, and saying at least that military options are on the table. Whether you believe that or not is another question.
One of the fallbacks for those of us who believe that a military action against Iran is far better than Iran having the bomb, bad as the option is, and the likelihood you've discussed this elsewhere about the likelihood that there will be retaliation of various kinds, and probably some of it very bad. But nonetheless, this is a less bad outcome than an unchecked Iran. Many have sort of turned to the Israelis to pull our chestnuts out of the fire on this. Do you think that really is in the cards, especially given what you know, Matt, about how difficult a mission it would be to strike even a relatively small number of these facilities, assuming you actually know where they are and how to get at them?
Well, I think the Israelis understand that their best options still run through Washington. I think they would like to see more crippling sanctions on Iran, but they can't make that happen on their own. They need the United States to do that. And if all else fails, I think Israel will be willing to use force. I don't think Israel is going to stand by while Iran builds nuclear weapons, but they understand that the U.S. option is much better. So if they think the United States is going to do it, I think they would hold off. But if at the end of the day, Iran's dashing to a nuclear weapons capability and it's clear that the United States isn't going to act, then I think Israel will take military action, even though, as you point out, their military option is not nearly as good as the United States option. So they could destroy the above ground facilities at Isfahan and Iraq. They might be able to get the underground facility at Natanz, because even though it's buried, it's not that deep or hardened. But getting Fordow, this facility buried in the side of a mountain under 295 feet of rock, is going to be really an impossible task for Israel. So they could do some damage to the program, buy some time, but not completely destroy it.
Do you think at this point, knowing what you do in just the public domain, of course, I've been reading of late about the massive ordnance penetrator bomb that is supposed to be capable of getting into and destroying or at least severely damaging deeply buried facilities, perhaps with one or more being used to do something of that kind to this Fordow facility. Do you think, Matt Kronick, that the United States has the capability to neutralize this, well, infrastructure that Iran is putting into place, even if we choose to do it ourselves?
Yes, I have no doubt that the United States has the capability. This massive ordnance penetrator, it's the largest conventional bunker-busting bomb ever created. Weighs 30,000 pounds, according to open source estimates, can penetrate 200 feet before detonating. So for Natanz, that would be no problem at all. Fordo is a little bit more difficult, but what the United States can do is put subsequent bunker busters in the crater left from previous bunker busters to essentially tunnel our way in. It takes some accuracy, but we can do it. So if the United States, bottom line is if the United States decided to conduct airstrikes on Iran's nuclear program, we could destroy the major facilities.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I fear we will have to do that, and pray that we have the capacity, and I know that it's becoming probably more difficult by the day. Let me turn finally to the question that I guess will be looming as Congress returns this week to take up one or more pieces of legislation concerning the so-called framework agreement of the Obama administration with Iran and the other members of the PERM 5 plus 1. Matt Cronin, what would you advise members of Congress to do at this juncture in light of all of the challenges and problems that you've just identified?
Well, I think they should make the administration stick to what America's nonproliferation policy has been in the past, that enrichment and reprocessing, especially in a rogue state, is unacceptable. And the only acceptable deal would be one in which Iran gives up enrichment altogether, and that Congress will continue to pass ever tougher sanctions on Iran until it agrees to that. And so if the administration wants to strike a deal, it's going to have to go for a deal where Iran gives up enrichment. And they've shown themselves to be quite creative, I think, in ways that have been unfortunate. But maybe they should devote that creativity to find other packages that would work, but that involve Iran giving up enrichment altogether.
And when you say enrichment, just to be clear, are you talking about also the Iraq reactor and its plutonium production capabilities, or are you giving them that just as long as they don't have the enrichment?
And that's an excellent point. So there are two paths to the bomb, uranium enrichment or plutonium reprocessing. And so we do need Iran to give up both. So that would include heavy water reactors like Iraq and reprocessing for the one path and then enrichment for the other. But light water reactors, research reactors, I think those could be acceptable as part of a final deal.
Matt Cronin, your eminent common sense and clarity on all these issues is really appreciated. Thank you for the work that you're doing at my alma mater, Georgetown University. I hope shaping young minds to be equally clear and principled. Also at the Atlantic Council, and the book is required reading, folks, A Time to Attack, The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat. Matt, I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Thank you for giving us a full hour of your time now, and all the best. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.